Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Jake Porter. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are glad that you are here. And today we're going to continue listening in on the presentation that I gave at the Exposed Conference in Portland, Oregon earlier this year on the subject of betrayal trauma. Before I do that, I want to mention again, in case you haven't signed up for it yet, a few opportunities that are coming up here. I want to mention the Multidimensional Partner Trauma Model Training. That is APSTAT's foundational keystone training that will be held November the 8th through 11th live online. If you are a helping professional and you have not yet taken this training, I want to strongly encourage you to do so. I did it several years ago. It is foundational to the work that I do. Later on in this year, on December the 2nd, Marie Krebs, another fantastic clinician, is going to do a workshop for helping professionals on how and when to refer to a higher level of care. You've got a client, goals aren't being met, treatment isn't seeming to work, and maybe there's just more that needs to be done, more than what you are capable of doing, what you've got the time or the capacity to do, the training to do. Marie is going to be talking about how to know when that's the case and what to do in those situations. That will be an online training sponsored by APSATS. So for more information on both of those opportunities, the Multidimensional Partner Trauma Model Training and how and when to refer to a higher level of care, go to APSATS.org. All right, today we are listening to part two of my lecture on betrayal trauma and how it forms, what's happening in the brain, how it's healed. And I do just want to say, as I mentioned last week before we played part one, this was a faith-based event, and there are times where I use some language of faith. But if you're not a person of faith or not someone who identifies as a Christian, I want to strongly encourage you to go ahead and listen to this, because really the bulk of it is more clinical information that I think you'll find really helpful. All right. Hope you'll enjoy the final portion of my speech on betrayal trauma to the Exposed Conference.
Now, what really happens when we're betrayed? What's really going on? So here's what happens. Every one of us here has something called an assumptive reality or assumptive world. Sometimes you'll see it that way in the literature. And your assumptive reality or your assumptive world, this is like your default programming, your default understanding of the world as it is. All right? And everybody's got one. And it doesn't mean it's perfect or all good. I mean, we know that there are bad things. So, but you take a partner who's being betrayed, but she doesn't know it or he doesn't know it, and they've got this assumptive reality about their lives. And our assumptive reality is largely built around the most important relationships in our lives. Okay? So she's got this assumptive reality that she knows, but there's also this hidden reality that she doesn't know. He knows it. And because he's able to compartmentalize so extremely well, which is probably rooted in trauma, that's a whole other talk, but he knows this hidden reality. She doesn't. She's operating on an assumptive reality that is incomplete, which means it's false, until worlds collide. Discovery happens in some way. Somehow she figures out. Now, in this moment, the human brain is wired so that even the perceived threat to a primary attachment relationship is experienced as a survival issue. So she goes into fight or flight. Frontal lobe, largely offline, limbic driven, fight or flight. This is all about survival now. And when your frontal cortical activity goes down and you're limbic driven and you're in survival mode, you're in fight or flight, you don't care about nuance. Again, that's a frontal lobe. That's a cortical thing. Nuance, complexity, shades of gray, reflection. Let's pause and think about this. Because everything is either good, bad, right, wrong, true, false, safe, dangerous, black, white. That's it. Okay? And so in this moment, what does her brain say about that black line? No. Not safe, not good, not right. This can't continue. Absolutely not. Something's got to change. Not doing that. You can't do that. That has to stop. Bad, bad, bad. Right? And if the gray line, if that assumptive reality allowed the black line to exist, what do I think about that? Not good, not safe, not true, not okay. So what's left? What's left? Nothing. Nothing. And that is a massive problem for the brain, whose job it is, number one, to keep you safe and alive. Because what is the best way to anticipate a future threat? By knowing the past. I can best anticipate what's coming by knowing what's been. And what just happened, if this is me, what's just happened is my entire sense of what has been, my whole storyline has just crumbled. Nothing. There's all this stuff I didn't know about. What I did think I knew, now I'm in a brain state that says none of that's true. I don't know reality. How can I be safe? How can I keep myself safe? How can I know how to make sure this doesn't happen again? How I'm not going to put myself back in harm's way? How do I know? And this is why betrayed partners begin to circle. Wait, but you were where? But I thought you said you were here. But what about this? But now, how does this fit with that? And then they go over it again. Hold on, just a minute. You were where? Say that where? Because why? This is not obsession. This is not rumination. This is not lack of forgiveness. This is a primal safety-seeking response of the human brain that is trying to orient itself to its own reality to understand how to stay safe. That's what's happened with betrayal that's suddenly discovered. That's the experience of the betrayed partner. And it's complex trauma because it's not just this one thing. It was what I now know you did on our honeymoon, what I now know you were doing at the birth of our first child. How I now understand you not wanting to have sex with me for months at a time. What I now know about what was really happening when I thought you were at work. All the question marks that I now have about what I don't know that I don't know. It's complex trauma. And so there's trigger after potential trigger after potential trigger. Layer upon layer upon layer. There's also the effects on the amygdala, which I call the broken fire alarm. So the amygdala is that part of the brain that's basically telling you to go into fight or flight or not, assessing whether you're safe in this moment or not. Okay? And from Psalm 55, a few more verses. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. Here's what we know happens with trauma. Oops, wasn't ready to go there yet. Here's what we know happens with trauma when you live in it for a long period of time. Again, not the punctiliar thing, but the complex thing where now I'm in it. Right? And I'm remaining in this place where I don't know if I'm safe or not, and I'm in fight or flight for a long time. I don't know if I'm okay. the amygdala begins being affected in such a way that my window of tolerance, in other words, how much can I tolerate, how much stress or distress or threat can I handle before I go into overwhelm or go into dysregulation, begins to narrow and shrink. The wear and the tear on the nervous system, there's literally a wear and tear on the nervous system, so that things that weren't a threat are later felt as a threat. Because as the window of tolerance gets narrower, I can handle less threat and stay whole and integrated. And so put these two together so far. So the corpus callosum functionality, that went down. So now I've got the trauma trigger time warp. And on top of that, a narrowing window of tolerance where I'm more sensitive to threat than I was. It's a torturous existence. It's an overwhelming existence. Now we're going to add to that this third component, and this is the hippocampus, how it affects the hippocampus. And I call this the dumped out file cabinet. Now this is where betrayal trauma is different from common, more standard PTSD. So in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, again, if you're looking at just PTSD, one of the categories of symptoms is avoidance. So usually when you have PTSD, you avoid trying to think about the trauma. But with betrayal trauma, there's this, I've already mentioned it, the circling. Wait, but what? But how? But what? But how? And that is specifically the effect on the amygdala. The hippocampus. The hippocampus. And we know even more specific to that, the left hippocampus. All right? So think of the left hippocampus as like the file cabinet of your brain, where every memory you have of all your experiences get filed away in this file cabinet. And so there they are, and they sit in this sequence. And the sequence turns it into a story. The sequence, gives each one individually some context, all right? And that context gives it meaning. So I'm going to mix my analogies, my metaphors here a little bit, and some of you youngins may not know what I'm talking about anymore. I had a 20-something couple in my office, and I tried to use this, and they just looked at me very strangely. But remember film strips? Right? Yeah. I remember film strips from school, and you'd load them up, and it's all these individual frames. Well, individually, it's just a still shot, but you put them in an order, and you run them, and it's a storyline. And so that's what this file cabinet kind of does, right? So I've got all my files. I've got them in order. This order creates a story with meaning. And thank you, Jeremy. And got it. Thanks. And so what happens when that black line is discovered? It's like someone grabs my file cabinet drawer, yanks it right out of the cabinet, dumps all the files onto the floor, then takes a whole stack of new files, really bad files, really painful files, throws them all in the mix. And now my hippocampus is going, where does this fit? Where does this fit? Wait, but this, where does this fit? Where does this fit? Where does this fit? Wait, but this, but this, but this. And this is why a trickle disclosure or a staggered disclosure is so devastating. Because a betrayed partner finally thinks, at least I've sequenced this piece of the story. And then all of a sudden, one new thing comes out, all back on the floor again. They can't just stick it right in there. They don't know to trust you. You're going to tell them, oh, it's just stick it right here. That's all it is. That's all there is to it. No. Back to the primal threat response. Back to it all being on the floor. And so what you have is this over and over, a new trauma, a new trauma, a new trauma. And so a lot of times, betrayed partners, they don't actually develop PTSD, but what's happening is it's a series of adjustment disorders where they can't heal because they keep getting new traumas every time they learn something new. And so that window for healing keeps getting kicked down the road because new trauma, new adjustment, new trauma, new adjustment, over and over and over again. My companion stretched out his hand against his friends. He violated his covenant. His speech was smooth as butter, yet war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. How do I trust you? You're telling me this is it. You're telling me you really love me. You're telling me. You told me that back there, and I now know you were also doing that back there. How does this fit together? What does this all mean? This is the experience of a partner who discovers betrayal. So how then do we actually help betrayed partners begin to heal? So in early treatment, safety and stability is essential to minimize trauma and the potential development of PTSD. And so again, this is a biophysiological issue. Remember what I said about that. This impacts capacity. And there's a literal impairment happening in the brain as a result of the trauma. Okay, you want to talk about forgiveness, which would be an ethical issue? You want to talk about forgiveness while their brain is in survival mode? No. No. They can't even go there. This is life or death. Full disclosure helps betrayed partners move from needing safety into being able to grieve. It's not the only thing necessary, but it's really important. A lot of people disagree with me on this next piece, and that's okay. Everyone has the right to be wrong. So, grief is where the healing happens. Grief is a hard process, but a meaning-making process. It helps me know how to create a new assumptive reality to move forward with my life, to not be stuck at the point of loss. Okay? Meaning-making, right? Grief is a meaning-making process, but grief is a luxury for the brain that knows it's safe. If I'm a soldier on the battlefield and my best buddy gets shot next to me, I don't stop and grieve him while there are bullets flying by my head and bombs going off all around me. Okay? Grief is a luxury for the brain that knows it's safe. And how do I grieve what I don't know I've lost? So the process of full disclosure, which absolutely should happen with a trained professional and not something you try to do on your own. Full disclosure, first, what it does is in one sitting with the support of professionals, you hand over to the betrayed partner all of the files. So it's not a couple this week, here's another one today, here's two more next week. Here they are. And I'm giving them to you having already done the context of putting them in the timeline of our lives. Around our 10th anniversary, this. When your mom died, this. And so I'm helping the betrayed partner. If I'm giving the disclosure, I'm helping my partner to get all the files in order. And now we can make sense of them. Now we can make meaning. Now we can do the grief process. But until I have all of that, my brain's going to go, but what? But where? But am I safe? But what? So that's a really important part of calming down the brain, calming down the nervous system, beginning to restore some functioning of other parts of the brain in a stabilizing way so that we can move forward into the grief work. that healing process in which the betrayed partner is going to find a new identity and a new story. Who am I now? I never wanted this to be my story. If I had a dollar for every time I've heard that, I'd have several hundred more dollars. What does this mean about who I am? What does this mean about my family? What does this mean about my world, about my life, about my story? And they can enter into that process. Through boundary development and values-based identity work, they can begin to restructure their relationships. They begin to be awakened to dynamics in the relationship that were never healthy, but that they excused or they came up with, you know, they just didn't know. They gave their partner the benefit of the doubt because that's what you do when you're married. You try to assume the best about your partner, and, you know, and so they tolerated this or that, and they tolerated whatever, you know, him working late every night or whatever it is, and now it's like, nuh-uh. That's not how we're doing this anymore. They find their voice. They set boundaries. They come up with their values of what they want their own lives and their relationships to look like. And they are restructuring now that primary relationship in their life, but also often many others. And so there's a reworking of the ethical dimension. And through the whole process, we pray gently and encourage openness to meaning-making through purpose-finding and post-traumatic growth. In other words, I'm not going to say this the first day. Well, I might say this the first day I meet a betrayed partner. Hey, I know this feels like death to you. Your marriage is dead. I get it. We serve a God who raises the dead. And you may not feel that hope in this moment, but I will hold that hope for you until you're ready to hold it for yourself. That's what we're trying to do. So a few important takeaways here. Humans are complex beings. Should be an S there. And all aspects of our complexity, both body and soul, were created very good by God, and are to be cared for and taken seriously, all of who we are. I mean, one of the things that I hope you're hearing as I teach you a little bit of the trauma stuff, the brain stuff, all of that, is like your body really matters. This is not just, you know, I used to think before I learned all this stuff that our thoughts were just thoughts. Like, what's a thought? It's just a thought, you know. But now I know that a thought is the result of electricity firing along certain neural pathways in my brain. So a thought is a thing. It's a thing in my body. Feelings are things. They're things in my body. And they matter. And your body was made good. This complexity of who we are is a good thing. It's a good thing. It's God's design. But both sexual addiction, more often than not, and betrayal trauma are rooted in attachment wounds and in these attachment traumas, right? Think back to my example of chronic shame. That's a relational wounding there that's happened, right? That causes the affect dysregulation, that I can't regulate my own affect. And so then what do? I turn to things on the outside to try to not feel this unpleasant whatever on the inside. That's an attachment issue. There's a great book that I would recommend, if you're into this, interested in this, actually two different books that I would recommend to you. One is called Addiction as an Attachment Disorder. Philip Flores is the author there. Addiction as an Attachment Disorder. And then there's one by Oliver Morgan, and I'm going to get the title slightly wrong, but it's something like Addiction, Attachment, Trauma, and Recovery. It's those four words in some order, okay? Oliver Morgan, I believe, is that author's name. And you just would not believe the research coming out right now that is showing the connection between attachment issues and addiction. Now, I'm not willing to say always. It's always rooted in an attachment issue. I'm not willing to say that. But the evidence is very clear that it very often is. So here we are, we're talking about sex addiction, and I'm saying to you that so often, at the root of it, it's an attachment issue. And now I've just told you that the experience of the betrayed partner is an attachment trauma, an attachment wound, right? So here's what that means. Both the addiction and the betrayal trauma are healed in and through reparative attachment experiences. That's how attachment ruptures are healed, is through attachment repairs. Attachment wounds are healed through the felt experience of secure attachment after that. And we know that this is true in the, you know, more traditional models of addiction recovery. So, and there, and it, within this room, I'm sure there's a diversity of opinion on things like 12-step programs, traditional ones or baptized ones, like Celebrate Recovery or that kind of thing, or just going the route of, you know, not 12-step based, but support groups. Are they peer-led, or do you have trained facilitators? Do you do it in the church, or should it be a para-ministry, you know, to the church, or para-church ministry? You know, like, what's the right way to do it? Do you have to have a therapist? Do you have to do group therapy? Do you have to, this, I mean, there's lots of ideas, but here's the deal. I'm just going to talk about 12-step. And the reason why I'm going to talk about 12-step is because there's actual, like, studies that support what I'm about to say. 12-step, do 12-step programs work? Well, it depends on how you set up the question. It's always about definition, right? What do you mean work? Well, if you just go to the meeting and you don't really participate, and all, then no, it doesn't work. But if you commit yourself to the meetings and you prioritize those meetings and you get a sponsor and you tell that sponsor everything and you work the steps, they work. Now, what's going on there? What are, in clinical terms, what's the mechanism of action that is bringing about the healing? Attachment. Relationship. Knowing and being known. Not being shamed. Getting honest. And becoming a part of something larger than myself. And you can do those two things in a lot of places. It doesn't have to be a 12-step program. You can do those two things in a church support group. You can do those two things in group therapy. You can do those two things with an accountability partner. But you know what? You can do those two things, be completely honest, and become part of something larger than yourself in your marriage. Why not leverage the most important attachment relationship in our lives for healing? Unfortunately, I think that a lot of more traditional models of recovery set couples on this your side of the street, your side of the street sort of setup. Send them on these parallel tracks. Here's your recovery, here's your recovery. And I'm not going to say it doesn't work. I'm just wondering if that's what would work best. Actually, that's a lie. I'm not wondering. I happen to believe quite strongly that what works best, not in each and every single situation without exception, but by and large, if these two people want to save their marriage, what works best is to put that marriage at the center of the process. That's why the model that I developed is called couple-centered recovery. Couple-centered recovery. And at the end of the day, there will be a slide up with a QR code where you can scan that and see a free webinar on couple-centered recovery, and I go into depth on all of that. But basically, my claim is this. Addiction, most of the time, at its root, is an attachment issue. Betrayal trauma is an attachment issue. The most important attachment relationship in someone's life is with their spouse. Why not leverage the power of the God-given, biologically wired-in attachment system for the healing of both people individually and the relationship as a whole. And that's where we're going to go later this afternoon.
You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@apsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.